Welcome, Rick.
Great to be here.
In your book, Buddha's Brain, you wrote, "To become happier, wiser, and more loving, sometimes you have to swim against ancient currents within your nervous system." What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that we evolved as humans over, in a sense, over 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system, roughly 60 million years or so as primates, and then, let's say, about 2.5 million years as makers of tools. Our ancestors 2.5 million years ago were making stone tools with a brain about a third our size. So over that period of time, call it 100,000 generations roughly, your brain and mine has, and everybody's brain really, has tripled in size. Now, along that long run, in order to survive, Mother Nature developed very effective ways to pass on genes. They involve things like being very, very alert to threats. Think about carrots and sticks. You know, getting carrots is important, but if you miss a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So we developed, among other things, a negativity bias in the brain that looks for threatening events or information, and then in particular stores those and reacts to those, for example. We also developed strategies that are very effective in terms of passing on genes that have to do with things like making distinctions between us and them. Because that's a really great way to get people in the Serengeti to take care of themselves, but, you know, compete very successfully with others. On the other hand, in the 21st century, you know, with a caveman, cavewoman brain armed with nuclear weapons, you know, that creates some serious problems. So sometimes in order to be happy, loving, or wise, we have to really acknowledge these ancient capacities as well as inclinations, and then have, you know, values and also have insight that enables us to overcome them.
Explain how negativity bias happens in the brain.
Well, that's quite a story, but this really bring it down to the bottom line. Essentially, there are systems in the brain that react to negative information. And for example, there's the amygdala. There are actually two of them, but they're always talked about in the singular. The amygdala, which is like an alarm bell in the brain, as well as the hippocampus, which registers context and setting, for example, for events. Well, these parts of the brain are primed to track negative information, and when they see it, for example, let's say you're in a business setting or in a relationship and, you know, someone gives you a dirty look, or let's say you're in a crowded restaurant and there's a hum of conversation and everyone's talking and suddenly you hear a voice speaking in anger, the whole restaurant gets quiet because we evolved to really track that kind of information because that's a stick. That's what's going to whap us and prevent us from getting any more carrots tomorrow. You know, so the result of all that is that positive experiences, unless they're sort of million-dollar moments, tend to kind of go right through the sieve, you know, in and out, whereas negative experiences are instantly registered. That's why I say that the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. The unfortunate result is that even if most of daily experiences are either positive or neutral, usually mildly positive, but nonetheless positive, they just go right through, and we gradually accumulate in what's called implicit memory, a growing pile of negative experiences, even if they're a tiny minority of what is happening in our day. And that, unfortunately, over time, shades our mood in an increasingly negative direction, makes us more pessimistic over time, and causes us to make very unfair judgments about ourselves and actually the world as well, that are tilted generally in a pessimistic and self-critical direction.
That sounds like a big bummer. What can our listeners do about this natural tendency for the amygdala to just latch on to negativity?
I think that in life there are basically three things you can do to make things better. You can intervene in the world, and that includes your relationships. You can intervene in your body, and you can intervene in your mind. And all are really, really, really important. In passing, I'll say I think that it's really important to deal with the negativity bias, to take up arms against your oppressors, in a sense. In other words, do things. You know, I've been a therapist a long time, and it's made me both more compassionate and also tougher-minded. I mean, it's really important to take action on your own behalf and make skillful plans and build resources in your life and in your world, and including, in particular, in your relationships. That's very important. Also, take good care of your body. All that said, a really great practice, honestly, I love it, because I like to feel good rather than bad. It's what I call taking in the good. And what I mean by that is that a great way to make the brain like Velcro for positive experiences and Teflon for the negative ones is to deliberately savor the positive experiences of life. Most of them are going to be very short. So I talk about three steps in my book. This is in chapter four. Number one, turn positive facts into positive experiences. All kinds of good things are happening, but we often don't let them move our needle. Instead, let yourself feel good for a dozen seconds. It's a private act. No one needs to know that you're feeling good.
Now break that down, because some people don't even know how to feel good.
Yeah, so let's say something happens. Let's say you get to the end of the load of laundry, or you're in a conversation with somebody that you feared would go badly and it actually went okay. Or someone paid you a small compliment, or someone was kind to you, or you accomplished something. You finished an important and difficult report. Those are good facts. Or you notice something about yourself, like that you're determined or patient or fair. Those are good facts. To let yourself feel good, relax the body, open up to the event. The body naturally wants to feel good. It's not like you have to make it feel good. And in fact, you have to undo the kind of hurried, rush, stress, tense tendencies that obscure, that block the natural inclination of the mind and the body to have positive emotional responses to positive facts. All right? That's step one. And then step two, for 10, 20, 30 seconds, it's kind of a mindfulness practice. Really be with the positive experience. Try to let it fill your body, make it last. There's a saying in brain science, neurons that fire together wire together. The more neurons you can get firing, and the longer you can get them firing, willy-nilly, automatically, they will start stitching together and gradually weaving positive experiences and positive resources into the fabric of your brain and yourself. And then the third simple step is just to sense and intend, kind of while you're savoring it, usually, that this experience is sinking into you. You know, people visualize it sometimes like a golden syrup coming deep down inside them, or I talk with kids about putting a jewel in the treasure chest of their heart. However you do it, what you're doing there is using prefrontal cortex executive systems to prime memory circuits to really internalize this positive experience. A single time you do it won't change your life. Half a dozen times a day, many weeks in a row, you'll feel different. Many months, even years in a row, you'll tend to feel really different. And you can also use this method to take in the supplies that will, over time, gradually fill the hole in your heart.
Humans have this unusual ability in the mammal world. It's called theory of mind. Explain that and what the impact is on relating, getting along with people.
Sure. One way to understand that is to think about a little kid, like a two-year-old roughly. And there are lots of clever experiments that do this. For example, one is basically an experimenter sitting on the other side of a big mountain that has a lake on one side of it. And the mountain is constructed so it can kind of twirl like a Lazy Susan. So you have the child sitting across from you, this little two-year-old, looking at the lake. And you ask the child, all right, what do you see? And the child will say, oh, I see a lake. And then you rotate the mountain 180 degrees, a half circle. So now the lake's on your side, and there's just mountain on the child's side. And you ask the two-year-old, what do I see? And the child will look at what she sees, let's say, and then will say, you see mountain. All right. The child doesn't register the fact that your experience is different from hers, let's say in that way. But a 3 or a 4-year-old, every single time, basically, will get that just because they're seeing only a mountain, your experience can indeed be different, and you're in fact able to see a lake. And that's an example of what's called theory of mind. And it's kind of a fancy phrase, but that's what it is. It's the idea that people develop sort of a theory or a notion of what in the world is going on inside the head of other people. What are their thoughts? What are their desires? What are their values? What are their intentions? What are their hopes? What are their dreams? What are their nefarious plans towards you? Whatever it is, that's theory of mind. And the development of that is actually a great breakthrough in childhood. It really develops actually really over the first 20 years or so of the lifespan in correlation with, in association with, how the frontal parts of the brain develop and mature over that same period. So many people have, that's the way I would just finish right there. The interesting point is that theory of mind is just one of three fundamental empathy circuits in the brain. They're all really important. Just quickly here, one set of circuits tracks the actions of others. Those are the so-called mirror-like networks in which we watch another person doing an action, and some of the neurons inside our head light up that also light up when we do that action ourselves, which gives us a feeling kind of from the inside out about where that other person is going, what they're doing. A second system located more in what's called the insula in the brain, which is kind of right in the middle of the brain on both sides, is tracking both the internal state of our own body and gut feelings, as well as the gut feelings or important emotions of other people. It's very, very important. I personally think tracking the emotions of other people, as well as in terms of theory of mind, tracking the thoughts, the intentions, you know, the personality factors and all the rest of other people is much more fundamental to everyday empathy than tracking mirror-like, you know, movements and motor planning and so forth. The wonderful news, of course, is that as humans, we've evolved these fundamental capacities to join with us, to plan cooperatively, to tune into each other, to be loving and caring.
But it seems like the amygdala's natural tendency to be negative and judgmental gets in the way of people creating a theory of mind. Isn't that the problem, that when we're interacting with people and we're upset with them, we stay focused on ourselves rather than being curious about what's going on for them?
I think that's true in some ways, but the thing to appreciate is that these capacities are neutral, in a sense that just like you can use a hammer to build a house or to bonk somebody on the head. And someone with autism would not be a good interrogator because they don't have the capacity to really tune in to the person they're interrogating or mistreating, alas, sometimes. And so I think that even when people are upset with another person, very often the person who's upset is generating what I call a case. They're making a case in their head about the other person. And very often part of that case is based on theory of mind. They're using theory of mind to make inferences about the intentions of the other person, their stupid thoughts, how they saw things wrongly, you know, how they wanted the wrong things. That's all mental content, you know, that we're inferring about another person. So it's not enough to deploy, if you will, these empathic capacities. We have to use them well. In other words, we have to, for example, use those theory of mind capacities to recognize the fact that running in the mind of the other person who, let's say, yes, did mistreat us in some way, did mistreat you, let's say, in some way, also running in their mind were all kinds of other things. Interpretations of what we did, underlying hurts from the last two or three times we interacted, the ways that they're already having a bad day, you know, based on their worries about their child or the guy who, you know, was cut them off on the freeway on the way to work, whatever it is, you know, looking past the surface. Well, I talk about, you know, seeing the being behind the eyes and looking past the eyes to the internal being, particularly the softer, more vulnerable, and sometimes younger layers in the other person. For example, typically there's hurt and fear underneath anger. So if someone's treating you badly, a really effective thing to do is to pause, have compassion for yourself, get on your own side, and then try to look clearly at what in the world is going on here. Because you've paused, you're buying yourself the time to do it if you possibly can. And in so doing, really try to sense into what is the hurt in that other person? What is their suffering? What are their fundamentally positive aims that they're pursuing in problematic ways? And then based on that, naturally what's evoked is compassion. And then based on compassion, you're not as likely to react so badly. You're going to feel better. It's not like you're rolling over and being a doormat. Paradoxically, seeing the other person suffering clearly and having compassion for them, A, makes you feel better, and B, helps you act a lot more skillfully on your own behalf.
Talk about the action step. What are some communication tips that you recommend to people when they want to get along? They want to be empathic, but they're dealing with their own reactive amygdala. What's a good thing to say?
This is a place where I think neuroscience, particularly thinking about it in an evolutionary framework in terms of biological evolution, is actually really helpful, because one of the handful of major takeaways in this emerging field, which is very exciting actually that it's emerging, it's just exploding in the last 10, 20 years, is to really appreciate how threat-reactive human beings are. we're at the top of the food chain because arguably we are the best at dealing with threats. And so we are continually scanning for threat and therefore really appreciating that sensitivity in us can take you in an interaction into being very thoughtful and attentive to the ways that A, you yourself are walking around in a paranoid trance. I think we all tend to float around in threat level orange, even though most of the time, truly, it's green. Maybe a little chartreuse. You know, there's a drop of yellow in the paint, but it's mostly pure green, really, day to day. And so to appreciate the way that we often overreact, that the truth is there isn't really a threat, or it's a tiny threat instead of a big threat, or it's a delayed threat, or it's a threat that came and went, or it's a threat, in other words, a challenge, a difficult situation, a problem, what have you, that one fully has the resources to deal with. That's another reason why taking in the good is so useful, because you start accumulating resources inside, and also you become more familiar with the resources inside you, so you naturally become more resilient and confident in dealing with events, so you don't feel necessarily so threatened by them. That's A. So in other words, helping yourself calm down and realize that you're not so threatened, really. You're not so harmed by this seeming terrible thing that happened from the other person. The other thing is to appreciate the ways that very often we needlessly give other people cause to fear us. And there's a traditional saying, you know, I have a background as a meditation teacher, and there's a traditional saying, give no one cause to fear you. And I have become a lot more thoughtful about needlessly doing things that trigger other people in small everyday ways. Not like I'm lifting that hammer like I'm going to bonk them or anything like that, but just little things like eye rolls, you know, playing superior, being a little snippy, being too fast, being too penetrating, you know, taking power in a way that's not actually really shared. Things like that, all these little ways, talking down to people in subtle ways, you know, leaking criticism. You know, those are all kinds of ways a person can be thoughtful about not needlessly triggering the other person. I think there's a place for saying what needs to be said. And paradoxically, the more you're able to settle into a place of peace inside yourself, so you're at peace with yourself and you feel at peace in your own body and you're at peace with the other person, paradoxically, that enables you to be stronger than ever. I've given a lot of thought to the integration of compassion and assertiveness, because either alone is not enough, but it's the weaving of the two together, the synergy of the two together, that's what this world needs today.
What's a communication tip for being compassionately assertive?
I could think of three things. First, really ground in a sense of your own strength. Because if you don't feel your own strength, which includes a healthy sense of boundaries between you and the other person, then you'll tend to feel overrun, beleaguered, invaded, and then naturally, of course, and threatened, and naturally, of course, you'll put up your walls or withdraw. And that's not a skillful way to be compassionately assertive. Second, really register what's going on here. Feel it. I think oftentimes, I mean, as I'm a couples counselor, and among other things, and I just watch things go too fast. So part of what I'm trying to do is to be like the graphite rods in a nuclear reactor. Slow down the interaction. So try to buy yourself some time so you can feel what's happening here, what's happening inside you, and in particular, what in the world is going on inside that other person, particularly the deeper layers, including what are their top priorities here? What is this really about for them beneath the surface? They might say it's about X, but often it's really about Y. What is this really about? And so if you buy yourself some time to do that, so you really register what's going on with the other person, you'll naturally feel some compassion for their suffering. I found for myself that looking at the face of another person and seeing the subtle suffering in it, the strain, the tension, the dissatisfaction, the hopes unfilled, all that sort of stuff both calms me down and makes me feel better, and also helps me be more effective with the other person. That's the second thing. And then I think the third thing is to be very clear about your fundamental aim here. Keep your eyes on the prize. So often I think we get distracted in extraneous side issues with other people, including, frankly, the side issues they throw up to keep us off the trail. Instead, keep going after what's your aim here? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the result? And as part of that, I talk about make agreements for the future. In other words, most fights and quarrels are about the past, which is rarely productive. The most important thing is what's going to happen from now on, which arguably are the three most hopeful words in the English language taken as a whole, from now on. So that's, I would say, those are good three things. One, strength. Two, really seeing what's going on and being compassionate. And three, keeping your eyes on the prize.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and today we're exploring the neuroscience of getting along. We're talking with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's speaking to us at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. Later on the show, I'll talk with Daniel Goleman, author of a series of books including Emotional Intelligence, Social Intelligence, and his latest, Ecological Intelligence. Rick, in your book, Buddha's Brain, you write about how you're concerned about modern life and that it leads to a pretty consistent arousal of the sympathetic nervous system. It's sort of that adrenalized feeling. What impact does that have on people getting along with each other?
It's a problem because while there's absolutely a place for positive activations, I think about how excited I got when our daughter, who was about 10 years old at the time, finally took a shot in basketball in the YMCA league she was playing in. I was so happy. There's completely a place for that. On the other hand, as I said earlier, because of the negativity bias in the brain, if you will, when we get activated, in other words, when we get excited or aroused or rushed, I mean, much of modern life is about rushing about. As soon as we're rushing about, we're getting activation of the sympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system. It's the fight or flight stress response wing. And it has its wholesome purposes. But as soon as you start activating that wing, you start warming up the circuits of fighting or fleeing. In other words, you start activating the system that is primed to go negative. So suddenly it's on a yellow flag condition. Yes, you can do a lot of good things under a yellow flag, but it's really helpful to appreciate the fact that you're under a yellow flag. That means that if we're stressed or revved up or preoccupied or rushing about, we're much more likely to be irritable. We're much more likely to take offense. We're much more likely to feel threatened when something was actually really trivial. We're much more likely to take things personally because rushing about activates the sense of self. You know, me, myself, and I, dealing with the world, you know, kind of outnumbered, beleaguered, but I got to get these emails done now, right? And as soon as we go into that mode, it's a lot more difficult to stay present, to be relaxed, to be connected, to see clearly what's happening with the other person, and so forth. So one thing I've really come to do out of all this is I kind of feel I've got a little needle. I've got an internal stress meter, and I'm just watching that needle a fair amount of the time. I'm not perfect by any means, but I'm just kind of tracking it. And when I start getting revved up, unless I'm, you know, I do a fair amount of rock climbing, unless I've just got to rev up to get over this darn overhang, but in more ordinary circumstances, like I'm revved up dealing with my wife and children, or I'm revved up with another person that I don't really need to be revved up about, I'll deliberately take some long exhalations or do other kinds of things that activate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system and calm that sympathetic fight-flight response down.
You mentioned taking a long exhalation. What are some other tips to slow that sympathetic nervous system down?
One is, as I said earlier, taking in the good and really focusing on positive emotion. In other words, if we're mildly happy, if we find ways to be grateful, glad, moments of contentment, appreciation, recognition of the good amidst the difficulties in the world. I don't mean ignoring what's not good. I mean seeing the world clearly. And the world as a whole is a big mosaic. It's got a lot of good, it's got some bad, and it's got a lot that's neutral. Most of us tend to not particularly dwell on what's actually really good in daily situations in particular. So looking at that and also using that as a way in for positive emotion. It doesn't mean that we're not sad sometimes or depressed sometimes or worried sometimes. As we get, you know, further along in terms of just kind of becoming in touch with ourselves and growing, increasingly it feels like our well-being starts expanding. You know, maybe it starts out as like a little puddle on the street. And, you know, if you dump a cup of salt, let's say, into a puddle, to use my metaphor, and drink from the puddle, it's going to be really yucky. But if you know, your sense of well-being gets larger and larger, becomes a pond, and then actually becomes a lake, you dump a cup of salt into that lake, let's say, feeling angry or stressed or anxious, etc., and then drink the water from that lake, that salt is going to be held in a much larger context. And that's what people talk about. Their well-being becomes increasingly unconditional and spacious, and it includes sad feelings and angry feelings and all the rest, but they're much smaller relative to the whole. So that's the second thing. Really focus on positive emotions. The third thing is to activate this parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, which dials down the sympathetic fight or flight wing. I named a suggestion already, which is long exhalations, because the parasympathetic system handles exhaling. So 3 to 10 long exhalations in a row, I'm telling you, it's hard to have your knickers in a twist in a stressful meeting if you do that, and no one needs to know you're doing it. Another great method is to relax the tongue. Parasympathetic system is very involved in the mouth. It's the rest and digest system in balance to the fight or flight system. That's another way too. And then the last one, I think, which goes to what we've talked about earlier in terms of evolution and the ways we're very, very threat reactive, is to really focus on a sense of safety. In other words, not perfect safety, but feeling as safe as you reasonably can. Most of us do not feel as safe as we reasonably can. We feel more alarmed, threatened, beleaguered, overwhelmed, and unsafe than we logically, reasonably need to feel. And the result is a lot of needless suffering as well as a lot of needless reactivity to others. Because when we're primed by our own feelings of not being safe, we're much more likely to take offense or lash out or overreact to situations. So, for example, I'll do little things like just remind myself that I'm okay, that this is a passing event, that I'm strong, that I don't have to agree, that I've got credit cards, you know what I mean? That I don't have to take it. I can deal. I can do something. I can make a plan. And minimally, even if I'm stuck in a yucky situation, I can do things inside my head. And then honestly, I'll admit some of my own personal methods as a sci-fi kind of guy as a kid. I just can hear Captain Kirk's voice in the back of my head. Shields up, Scotty. And I'll just imagine some kind of shield going up, if you will, between me and another person that I can see what's happening out there, but nothing's coming in to harm the core of my being.
I'm a little confused about these mirror neurons because there's a lot in the popular literature about how important they are. Does that mean that if I smile, I make you smile?
Well, yes and no. There are subtle effects that can happen, and smiling is contagious, and it's a very good thing, particularly a genuine smile. Now, we can think of all kinds of smiles, like Dr. Evil, if you will, kind of smiles that don't make people feel really comfortable. If the mouth is smiling but the eyes are not, that's really, really creepy. So, yes, there are ways in which, in everyday life, we are connected with each other in ways wonderfully that, for example, relative strangers, people sitting side by side on a bus trip for a few hours will connect with each other and be kind to each other and go out of their way for each other. It's absolutely true. And that's why I think that in daily life, whether it's in business or in home, it's really thought, it's good, it's skillful to be thoughtful about body language. You know, are we leaning away from someone who's trying to connect with us? I mean, there's a classic dynamic in relationships, or pursuer or distancer. Instead, can we lead toward them, give them what they really need from us for a few minutes, and then let the interaction move on? Otherwise, they're going to keep banging on our door, you know, trying to get their needs met. So leaning forward physically, looking in the eyes, really tracking little movements around the eyes is a great way to start being drawn into the inner being of another person. Using as well that method I described as, you know, looking past the eyes to the being behind the eyes over there. That's also really effective. But I think in addition to the mirroring part of actions, it's more fundamental to tune into your own gut feelings in your body and open up to resonating with the emotional state of the other person, and also kind of keep, it's a little scientific, not really, but it's like generating little hypotheses in your mind. What's going on with this other person? And by the way, I don't mean doing that when everything's going fine. When everything's going fine, you don't have to do any of this stuff. But if there's a problem, if you're in the middle of a difficult conversation, I know one of your early books was about difficult conversations. And if you're in a difficult conversation, I think about this. My wife's bothered by something, and it could be me, right? You know what I mean? What do you do then, right? If you're in one of those moments, it really does help to give a little thought to what's happening inside the other person, make a little hypothesis, in other words, a bit of a guess, right? And then test it out. See, is that actually what's going on over there?
What do you mean by test it out?
I mean, if I, for example, let's say I have this notion that my wife is bothered by the fact that even though I said I would be home by 6 for dinner, I rolled in at 6:30 and I didn't acknowledge the fact that I just wasn't half, I was a half an hour late and dinner was cold on the table when I finally sat down. And so I might wonder about that. And, for example, I might just ask her, gee, honey, are you kind of mad here about the fact that I put the glasses in the dishwasher the wrong way because 3 hours ago I rolled in late for dinner? Is that what's really going on? Right? Or I might just, for example, know that that could be true and make a change on the spot. I mean, in my book, I talk about unilateral virtue, for example. It's the idea that we operate by our own code regardless of what the other person does. And paradoxically, it's a fantastic method for helping ourselves feel strong and also act a lot better toward other people, because how we're acting is not contingent on whether they're, you know, playing by the rules or not. We reserve the right to unilaterally, as we can at least, shrink the relationship, back up, say what needs to be said, look them in the eye and use blunt language if we've got to do that. But on the other hand, we unilaterally decide to stay virtuous, you know, to use the word, to operate by our own code, because that was going to make us feel better. And it's also the best odds strategy to elicit good behavior from other people.
Rick Hansen, in your book, Buddha's Brain, you have a term called the bliss of blamelessness. How do people develop that when we have these really reactive amygdalas?
Well, I didn't coin that phrase. I think that's from the Buddha, actually. But it is a bliss of blamelessness. It's to feel that, you know, in this situation, my intentions were good. I acted with clear understanding as best I reasonably could. In other words, I'm holding myself to a standard of reasonable conduct. I don't have to be a saint. I don't have to be a mind reader. I just have to operate as well as a reasonable adult, let's say, could in a particular situation, and also acted skillfully. So my intentions were good. There was clear understanding, and there was skillful action. I wasn't in it to harm the other person. I didn't get my ego involved. I was there to, you know, try to be a decent guy. I mean, ordinary decent guy. My part of my family comes from the Midwest, and culturally, a lot of that's kind of my roots. And I just think, be a regular Reader's Digest kind of good guy. You know, I used to be a Boy Scout. Just be a decent person. You know, I think back to being in kindergarten, these three great lines, you know, pay attention, be nice, share your toys. I mean, that's words to live by. Okay, that's the bliss of blamelessness. And then when you're in that place, then you're not second-guessing yourself. And you're also creating wonderfully positive cycles in your dealings with other people. Because the best odds strategy, it's not a guarantee. Some people are going to keep coming at you, even no matter what you do. And then you've got to deal in a very real way. And that's where that assertiveness part comes in, and that inner strength, and the capacity to be on your own side and take unilateral action to get your needs met in a situation. But that said, if you do act with the bliss of blamelessness, it's most likely that the other person's going to calm down. They're going to see the light. They're going to start looking foolish if they keep, honestly, acting all reactive and kind of like a jerk, and you're being cool and calm and clean in your dealings with them. Other people are going to notice. They're going to notice that other people are noticing. And ultimately, you're much more likely to prevail.
Rick, we've been talking about empathy, which really involves connecting with another person's experience. But let's talk about it on a more global level, say nation to nation. How well are we doing empathetically?
I think we're doing horribly. I mean, to use the kindergarten model, which I think is a good standard, you know, it's kind of an entry-level standard for conduct. I mean, imagine that you got a kindergarten, let's say, with 225 roughly, that's how many nations there are in the world, ballpark, probably more these days actually, kids running around your schoolyard. How are they acting with each other? I mean, or just think about sort of the leading players in the world, you know, let's say 20, 30 kids in your classroom. Each one is a nation, and the U.S. is just one of them. I don't think we're treating each other very well, really. I think there are some good things that are happening. I mean, I think it's really useful to take the long view in terms of human history. Think back on the days of the Dark Ages, 1,000 years of feudal systems in the Western world, or the equivalent in much of the rest of the world. Think back on the Roman Empire. Think back on the ancient wars. Think back on hunter-gatherer cultures, in which, honestly, to put it in perspective here, in the 21st century, it's estimated that 1 in 100 males died due to war. Well, the estimates about hunter-gatherer cultures, in which humans, which are the best approximation to the bands in Africa in which humans evolved, the death rate due to violence for males is about 15%. In other words, it's about 15 times greater. So, you know, in that long context,
you know, there are some bright spots in the world today. But I think one of the things to really be careful about, and this is, again, where I think neuroscience really has a lot of applications and implications, is to appreciate what happens as soon as you make the distinction between us and them and start regarding them as not quite human, not having as legitimate needs, being evil or bad or wrong or misguided or deformed or tainted in some kind of, or defective in some kind of way. And as soon as you do that, the wolf of hate in the heart has two wolves in it, to use the traditional Native American saying, a wolf of hate and a wolf of love. Both wolves are present, and it all depends on which one we feed every day. That wolf of hate starts getting up and growling as soon as we make that kind of distinction between us and them. Right there, it's a yellow flag condition, right? As soon as we make that us-them distinction, it starts waking up and starts feeling threatened, and it starts looking how to exploit and attack. And then as soon as we start feeling threatened, as soon as we start making up a case about how we've been mistreated by those people over there or who are about to threaten us, then the wolf of hate really gets up and going. That's why I think media is wonderful in terms of particularly grassroots media, like what you're doing here. I think about the phrase, the democratization of access to tools, things like the internet, things like revolutions being accomplished by people with cell phones or taking video tapes, making recordings of police, you know, of the, of, you know, things, bad things happening, let's say, in their country, and then posting it worldwide so everyone can see that. In other words, ways of breaking down that us-them distinction and helping ourselves to see that those people have children too. Those people have hopes and dreams. Those people suffer. Those people have pain. Those people look at us in a threatening way. And in so doing, that, I think, is a good way to begin promoting the power of empathy on a worldwide scale. But it comes from appreciating and being honest about and not sentimental about the capacity in the heart of every single one of us to get that wolf of hate up and snarling.
What I'm hearing you say is things are improving. I'm curious how much more they could improve. Is it possible that 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now, the amygdala would be much smaller or much less reactive because people are feeling safer and more secure and less threatened?
That's a very interesting question, actually. And your time scale is the right one. I mean, to think about biological evolution, you really need to think about thousands of years at a minimum, and ideally tens, hundreds, or thousands of thousands, in other words, millions of years and longer, to really think of serious organic change. The thought that because with material comforts increasing, at least for much of the world, let's remember 1 billion or so or more people go to sleep hungry every night, I think there is a plausible possibility that these ancient alarm circuits, which did evolve with mammals like dogs, for example, have an amygdala, squirrels, you know, have these kind of systems too, and even reptiles and fish have other kind of alarm response systems and so forth. You know, they evolved to deal with physical threats. And as physical threats diminish, I think it's arguable that the biological need, you know, for these alarm systems will also diminish, and therefore they'll shrink a bit. On the other hand, we're very social animals. Most amygdala hippocampal reactivity is for social threat. It's for social signals. If we get upset, if we feel wronged, if someone's angry at us, if we feel mistreated, or we want to belong to a group, and we get cast out or we don't get included, and especially if we feel there's been an injustice done that we take personally, right then and there, boom, amygdala hippocampal arousal. And I don't know if that's going to go away from the standpoint of evolution. I think the real crux is what we do with these systems. You know, in other words, at the end of the day, to put it like this, one of the things I write about is how to use neuroscience, turbocharged by contemplative wisdom, to use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. In other words, it's the idea of using mental activity in a skillful and very targeted way to stimulate and therefore strengthen the neural circuits that promote positive states of mind. That, I think, is where the real possibilities are.
it's not so much about changing the amygdala hippocampal circuitry and so forth. Let's remember that those systems are also involved in warmth and love. They're involved in heroic activity. I guarantee you, when Gandhi was leading the salt march or was involved in the salt march, you know, in India during the freedom movement, if you will, there for independence, he had a lot of amygdala hippocampal arousal because he needed that, you know, to direct him in a good way. So I think the key point here really is, are we going to be passive and just swept along by these ancient evolutionary currents that drive us toward emotional reactivity, a negativity bias, and fearful aggression toward them, you know, involving the snarling wolf of hate? Or will we also alternately use the human capacities for love, for reflection, for learning, for self-direction, and for virtue and morality and unilateral virtue? Will we draw on those instead? And to me, that's the critical choice. The planet's poised for me on the edge of the knife, or the edge of the sword, if you will. It could go either way. There are a lot of good things that are happening. I'm actually quite optimistic, ultimately, about where we're going to go. I think there are going to be a lot of bumps along the way. But enlightened self-interest, we're all in the lifeboat together on planet Earth, obviously. It's a metaphor used by other people. But enlightened self-interest alone recognizes the fact. Like, for example, nuclear weapons. Use a nuclear weapon on another country, the dust and fallout is going to come back and, you know, irradiate your own children. There's no way around it. We're in the lifeboat together here. If you have people starving across the world, they're going to do things that are going to interrupt your oil supply here at home, for example. So, you know, the larger point really is, what are we going to do? And I think that's where the burden is on each one of us, to take responsibility inside our own heads. The thing we can do more than anything is what's inside our own brain, right? We have little impact about what's happening in foreign capitals and or our own capital, most of us at least. There's a lot of impact inside our own head. Use the mind skillfully to change the brain, to change the mind for the better, and then allow those ripples of benefit to spread far and wide to make this planet a better place.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and today we're talking with Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist and author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's speaking to us at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. Later on today's show, I'll talk with Daniel Goleman, author of a series of books including Emotional Intelligence, Social Intelligence, and his latest, Ecological Intelligence. Rick Hansen, it seems like a lot of people have anxiety today, and that's got to impact how people get along in terms of fear and isolation and non-assertiveness. Give our listeners some contemplative practices that could help with social anxiety.
Where to begin? First of all, as Dan Siegel has developed wonderfully, if one attunes to oneself, in other words, if one is mindful, if one just takes a few moments to be self-aware, to be present with oneself, I call it intimate with oneself, just what's going on here, that internal sense of attunement helps give to one's innermost being the kind of empathic, present, caring recognition of what's really, really going on.
How do you do that, though, if you're having a panic attack? Because people don't want to feel their panic.
Well, if you're having a panic attack, I've had one in my life, and you feel like you're about to die. Right. The thing you need to do with a panic attack is remember, no one has ever died of a panic attack, and they all end, usually within minutes. Those two things will really get you through. They'll help you get through the next panic attack. Then when you're not panicking, you go to work on reducing the causes and conditions that lead to panic in the future. And there are all kinds of ways to do that that are probably not the topic here, both psychological and ultimately sometimes pharmacological. But in the moment of a panic attack, you just try to ride it out without creating too much harm for yourself or other people, and then figure out afterward what to do. What I was thinking about was more the everyday anxiety that we experience, the kind of background trickle of unease and apprehension or overt worry in the front of the mind, you know, the stuff that keeps us up late at night. And those sorts of fears are, I think, quite helped by a number of the tools in the contemplative toolbox.
There are, of course, other tools. As a clinical psychologist, I have a fair amount of number of tools, you know, as well. That are, it's a different toolbox. But in the contemplative toolbox, I think, one, mindfulness is a fantastic tool. But just tuning into oneself, you give yourself in the moment the felt sense of being seen and understood and cared about that we all need intensely from other people because we're such social animals, and children, of course, really, really need, particularly when they're young.
Break that down. When you say tune into yourself, give me the 1, 2, 3 steps how I do that when I'm feeling a little bit of anxiety, maybe in a professional meeting or a party.
Sure. I would say start with self-compassion. In other words, start with the goodwill for yourself combined with a sense of tender concern. Because if you don't start there, it's uncomfortable to open up to anxiety. In other words, you know, build a secure base. Start by working on your own secure base. And then I open out into these painful feelings. I think sometimes people jump into mindfulness before they've really established a secure place inside. So let's work the fundamentals first. Now, to go further even, because I know you're going to ask me this, because if I don't say it, you're going to have me break it down further, how to do self-compassion. Okay, so let's acknowledge first that that's actually really hard for a lot of people, oddly hard. You know, people who can be very compassionate toward other people don't particularly wish themselves well or don't particularly care that much if they're suffering. They just kind of soldier on stoically. Well, so I do this in some neurologically savvy ways. I'll take your listeners through 3 steps that are pretty effective. Number one, bring to mind the felt sense of being with someone who cares about you, someone that you know loves you, wishes you well, cares about you, and let yourself feel cared about. Relax, open up. We naturally want to feel cared about. It's not, we just have to open up to it, particularly by holding in mind the sense of being with a person who cares about you. It could be your grandma when you were little baking you cookies. Could be a pet today. Could be a friend or a mate today. It could be spiritual. It could be a sense of the divine, God, or a spiritual figure caring about you. Whatever it is, you're with someone who cares about you. One. Two, bring to mind someone that's naturally easy for you to have compassion for you to wish that they not suffer, to feel pity or sympathy or sorrow or concern when you see that they're in pain. It could be a child or children in general. It could be a friend of yours. It could be a pet as well. Anyone that naturally evokes caring out of you. And then third, bring to mind a version of yourself, and for many people it's when they were a little kid, that naturally is easy to feel compassion for. When you imagine yourself as a little kid, completely innocent, just bopping along, eating popcorn, you know, skinning her knee, skinning his knee, what have you, you know, would you naturally have compassion for yourself? Yes. And then gradually apply that sense of compassion for yourself today. There's a lot of research on self-compassion that shows that it's very powerful, including in many ways more powerful than simple self-esteem because it's emotional. So that would be one thing to do to help oneself get ready to face one's anxiety. And then on the basis of having that secure base, if you will, open up to what's going on in the body. Notice that the body is nervous and see if you can look at it almost impersonally. There is sensation there. There is feeling there. There are thoughts of threat and alarm. There are, ruminations or, you know, circular laps around the track, if you will, of worries about things. All that is present. One doesn't have to identify with it. One can observe it. It's a little bit like instead of being in the movie, getting out of the movie, off the screen, and in the seat, having some of that popcorn I talked about. That right there is a kind of mindfulness of the anxiety. So you are, in the contemplative traditions, deconstructing it. You're breaking anxiety down into its physical sensations, its related emotions, its associated thoughts. And as you do that, as you see directly how it is, that this experience is not this congealed mass landing on your head, overwhelming you, but is actually made up of many little parts that come and go and kind of swirl around. I talk about them as eddies in the stream, you know, flotsam and jetsam, leaves and twigs kind of spinning on by. As you see it in that way, suddenly it starts getting more impersonal. It starts seeming sometimes kind of ridiculous. You can see it coming and going. You know it will come to an end. And that's a great way to get some detachment from it.
Rick, it seems in terms of getting along with people that attitude has a lot to do with it. Now, one really destructive attitude I have is entitlement. I'm in a customer service situation, and I feel like I'm entitled to great customer service. And I always get disappointed, right? I've been trying this new attitude that I call, everybody is my customer. And it's weird. It really makes a difference. It shifts the whole context of how I look at people. Could you talk about attitudes in getting along, and how can people shift their attitude, or is that just pouring chocolate on dirt?
That's great. Well, to borrow a line from someone else, if you don't want to get disappointed, don't get appointed in the first place. In other words, don't appoint in your mind that things have to be a certain way in the first place. And that's a great way to not get so disappointed. I love your example. I get it. I think there are a couple of points here. First, it underscores the importance of attitude. Our orientation, the way we frame things, our perspective going into a situation, tons of research on this in terms of social psychology and other things, really frames and really sets up, really primes, really inclines us, really biases us to what we're paying attention to in a situation and what we're ignoring and what our priorities are and how we're also starting to get kind of ramped up. You know, because if you think about that entitlement attitude, it's a little ramped up. And all that sets us up for a negative response. So that's point one. Pay attention to attitude. That's to, again, use a familiar line. That's why I think the attitude of gratitude, for example, is so helpful. Going into a situation, instead of having an attitude of deficit or shortfall that you want remedied, let's say, by this customer service person or your coworker or your mate, instead of that, you go into the situation focusing on what you're already glad about, what you're already grateful for, what's already okay in your life, what's already working in your life, what's already good inside you. Not like you're trying to pretend that you're a rock star or you're wearing a halo, but just factually, in ordinary ways. You know, that Reader's Digest Midwestern kind of way. What's already okay and decent inside you. When you go into a situation like that, you're already full. I think about these three fundamental motivational systems in the brain and the distinction between the ways in which they operate when a person is suffering and causing harm versus the ways that they operate as people progress in their own personal growth and in a spiritual frame move down the path of awakening, how those three systems operate in ways that are based on happiness and wisdom rather than suffering and harm. And one of those three systems is about approaching rewards and trying to get our needs met. If we already feel full and glad and grateful and satisfied, then we're less likely to activate that system in ways that are problematic to get our needs met right here and now on this phone call. I'm calling. I want my washer today, now, you know, and so forth. So I think that's a really good context. In other words, to start by filling yourself up initially, you know, before you go into a situation in terms of your attitude. The last thing I'll say about attitude is that I've just had a growing sense of the ways that other people are having a bad day. That life's hard for them. It's not. I don't mean that their house burned down and their dog was run over or whatever. But they're just having a tough day. They're stressed. They're worried. Life's tough. I mean, walk down the street. Look at the faces of people. If you have any illusions about there's not enough negative experiences in the world to go around, you know, those illusions will be just blown apart by looking in the faces of other people. And when you see the difficulty, the stress, the hassles, the challenge of other people, you become a lot more patient. You become a lot more forbearing. Weirdly, you actually get more effective in getting what you want because you're not provoking other people needlessly. You're not getting their knickers in a twist. You're not triggering a case inside their head about why you're a jerk and why you don't deserve good treatment here. There's a traditional metaphor, for example, that says that the world is covered with, you know, as thorns and sharp rocks. Okay? The world has difficulty. What do we do? And the world includes other people who are having bad days, who are stressed, who are upset, who aren't seeing very clearly, who aren't particularly taking responsibility for themselves, let's say, and so forth. What do you do? Well, you could cover the world with leather. That's one solution, right? Or you could put on a pair of shoes. And just in your personal dealings, locally, with what's around you, have these little buffers, if you will, between other people that help you recognize their difficulty over there, the ways that they're having a bad day. So between you and them, there's kind of a shock absorber, kind of a space between you and them that helps you not get so reactive and also reduces your anxieties about being with them.
Dr. Rick Hansen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.